And we're live. Alright, so we'll see how this goes and just see how randomly we can actually make sense of ourselves and where we're at as supposed techies and just ambitious people trying to supposedly change the world. What does that even mean?
Yeah, actually, what does changing the world mean?
It's a difficult thing to do or to define it. Change the world. Obviously, everyone tries to change the world from that perspective. So obviously, the best way to change the world is to try to solve something that you do or something that you want to see fixed and then somehow just propagate to everyone else. That's me, normally. It's probably I try to fix something that may be painful in my life, and then by doing that, I'm probably hoping that it's going to affect other people. On average, it does, but that's how I go about things.
Yeah, maybe if you can elaborate on some of the things that you can say, look, this was a pain in my life, and so I attempted to solve it. Possibly some results as well.
Yeah.
And all that.
All right, interview. Take Mike.
Oh, no. Yeah. No pressure.
Let's see. That's how it came across.
Yeah. So, me in general, obviously, I'm always passionate about, helping people, right? Just getting from where I am and try to give back in some form through teaching. Meaning, I'm here, I've learned a few things, and then I'm assuming now if I give it back to somebody else who can maybe replicate what I'm doing, they can get to a certain point or even higher or better, whatever the case may be. That's pretty much how I've been doing things. That's why I have my NGO and stuff, those kind of stuff, just to try to fix those things. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay.
That's the starting point, I guess.
That's pretty cool. So, what does your NGO do? Like, tell us a bit about that, actually. I remember you started that a few years back.
Yeah.
Glad to hear you still talk about it.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Just give me a drink there.
Right, so, yeah. You've got some ice movements in the background.
Yeah, and, so the name is Life After Matric.
Okay. So, it's obviously that's targeted at high school kids, huh?
Yeah, essentially,
like
yes.
Post high school.
Yeah, no. Before that.
Okay.
Because that's why the name, Life After Matric. The main thing is, pretty much what I explained then, the main thing is to try to expose people to what happens after matric. There's different things that you can take. University is not the only thing that you can do after matric. So the main thing is to do stuff, right? So we try to expose people to different things after matric that anyone can do, whether you have money or not. So that's essentially what we do. That's like on a nutshell. Obviously now if you go into the nitty-gritties of it, you'll have like different departments and how to go about it. But the overall thing is to show your matriculants or not matriculants, but your high school people how life after matric based on what I've experienced it to be. And then from that, you might learn something and then do something different or take that, be inspired with it and then run. Or so I don't want to do that. Let me do this way. So that's essentially that. So, yeah.
That sounds pretty
good. It's quite interesting.
I was also looking at doing something similar, but for me, it's like targeted to graduates. So, it's so fun because I started, I think, a series of called Dear Poor Graduate, which kind of derives from that. Do you guys know that guy, Janssen Johnson or something? JJ, from, he was a retired first aid. Yeah, he was a retired vice chancellor there. So, he was like, yeah, the series called Dear Jobless Graduate. Kind of explaining like to black people like why you're graduating the jobless and stuff.
Yeah. So wait, Jensen whoever was explaining to graduates like about why they are jobless?
Yeah. Remember there was that phenomenon of like lots of graduates, you know, like being jobless and shit.
Okay.
But it's still happening, yeah?
To some extent it's still happening.
It's still there, it's not going even down, it's just going up.
Yeah.
Every year.
Yeah.
I mean I think there's some crazy stuff that's I think the stats essay was producing stats a couple of months ago, last year. And one of the funny stats, obviously you never know with these statistics posted on Facebook, but basically the idea was that we have an increase in the amount of graduate professionals not getting jobs in government, and you have an increase in the amount of people in government owning senior positions without qualifications. So you kind of like have the situation where you've got a lot more unqualified people having solid positions. But this was for government, though.
On that.
And would you, graduates just not getting positions at all?
Would you rather have a government which is well-educated, like, for example, the USA's government, where almost every one of them is like a lawyer of some sort? Or would you rather have, obviously, South Africa is a different context because now it was more of a struggle, and whoever was part of the struggle sort of should, to some extent, get a position, but not. But now going forward, should we also try to be educated? And whatever, I don't know how what educated means, but should we aspire for those kind of governance?
Yeah.
If we do, because like now, like with the EFF, they were saying they expect like almost everyone in government or high senior parliament positions, they should have some sort of qualification, a degree, whatever. But now, is that relevant for SA, or we still, like, do you guys believe in those kind of stuff?
Does it matter? At the moment, when it comes to the government, right, I think they don't really look to the universities you guys got to, or they don't even look to the scholars, right? Because the government people, they look for older people. Which is older people aren't really that educated, but they still get to the places because they were there before. And about changing the world and stuff, you need to change the government. And you cannot change the government at the moment.
Okay.
Until you guys would think that way, go up to that state that you guys, okay, I've done my career, now I want to go to the government initiative. Because you guys at the moment, you're just concentrating at your careers first.
Okay, so like, what is it on that? Like, what is it about education that people want other people to have? Because if you say, in government, we want, like, for me to be president, you should have like, at least a degree in whatever. Like, what is it about education that gives you? Is it the way of thinking, or does it validate? Like, based on the community we live in, the society we live in right now, does it validate a certain thing about you that we required?
For me, I think I'll answer that at two levels. Initially, it was a question of whether or not actually we do need those people in government, right? The educated people, are we ready for that?
Do we want them? Or do we don't care? As long as you're willing to serve, then you can serve. Or you need to be willing to serve and also be achieved in a certain thing. Right now, it's called education.
For me, I think that education is an added benefit of what I call, in economics we call it externalities, which are basically like spillovers, right? For instance, the fact that I can sit down with you guys and talk about things like complicated things like blockchain is particularly because of my educational exposure, right? That I can now sit down and have a technical conversation, and you guys can sit and talk about politics. And also that the fact that like the ease with which someone can play with different ideas. So one people with ideas, and those ideas are usually generated over time, especially like with education. Either with education shows that actually you can accumulate knowledge. You see, and that's what you need. Because let's say you're interacting with different people. You wanna be able to like be able to have that discourse. Like I don't think right now you can sit down with someone like Zuma and discuss blockchain, you know, and have a constructive conversation. Whereas you can sit down right now.
Does it matter?
To some extent, it matters. Because if you look at how the world is moving, there's what is called infotech. Obviously, that's the age we're living in, whereby information becomes relevant over time. You see? So with information being relevant, and it can help us like achieve many things, for instance. For instance, now you know that with your information, you can actually monetize it and sell it to someone. You know? So like, for me, the importance of that, someone being able to recognize and realize that the importance of that matters, especially with someone in government, because you're interacting with different people. Okay. Your ability to assimilate information matters.
Well, I think the first thing like that comes to mind is like, first of all, separating education, formal education, from the concept of being educated or being knowledgeable or being an intellectual. And the first assumption to kill is that just because you went to school, or school is the only source of education, or school is the only source that could actually make you intellectually competent.
That's where they go.
All right, to actually, you know, do something. So I think on a basic level, I mean, we want people in government or in power to be competent. And I believe, you know, competent because at the end of the day,
they've got a job,
and we want to trust them with the ability to fulfill their mandate. We believe in them. We put our trust in them that they will be able to lead us and pretty much do whatever it is they obviously claim they can do.
Okay.
So a basic criteria is for them to be competent. Mm-hmm. Now, what does competence mean? And my argument is that education is only one aspect of that competency. Right, because obviously, I mean, education, what do you mean by education? You mean that they went to school, they learned how to read books.
Got some paper.
They, besides getting the paper, they trained themselves on various techniques on how to do research, how to read, and come to various conclusions. I mean, basic things like project management. They learned that, you know, when you get a big fat amount of money, you need to come up with a plan so that you can use the money constructively.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now school is not the only place you learn that. You can learn that through the internet these days. You can learn that through general knowledge and experience that people have in life. Mm-hmm. So I think the first thing I'd remove is that I don't really think it's purely about having a degree.
Yeah.
But of course, it's more likely that if you had a degree, that you would have certain competencies that somebody on average didn't. So if we took 1,000 people that didn't go to school and 1,000 people that did go to school,
so
it's probably
saying,
more likely that the ones who went to school
so
have certain
the world
competencies.
Is more, like there's more trusting on the stats. Like it's a thumb suck, but because we trust the stats, I say it's probably, I'm just picking a number, 65% of the graduates are competent. So we'd rather go for that or just, you know, like just go to some area and get 5 people who are willing to do the job and then bring them in.
Well, I don't think it's a thumbs up of the stats. Sorry, Ignatius.
Yeah.
I think that we've got probably a lot of evidence to suggest that it's not just a thumbs up. I think that formal education, what you call human capital, essentially is important, and you get it through education. Those who get it outside of education are outliers.
Yeah, I mean, you're,
all right, so... Yeah, I mean, education is key in that process. It's not the only source. I think it solves one layer of the political problem which we're facing, which is just the basics of do the fucking damn job, you know? But as you go to America, then you see that even when the education is there, you now have other layers of problems with your politicians. And that's where you have another discussion about, is education enough? What type of education are they getting?
Yeah, I mean, we do also have guys like what you're asking for, like guys like what's his name, Stern Rosen, the chief whip of DA. That guy apparently has done amazingly well in his projects, huh? So he actually does deliver, but doesn't have like.
Let's talk about that. Amazingly well.
Okay, number one. I remember I was actually involved with the KZN government, and he was actually he actually rose through the ranks to get to where he is now. He's now the MP, right? He actually is here to rise through the ranks.
Like all white people, of course, he raised the ranks.
And even like in parliament, when he's actually conducting his discourse, you can tell that, you know, he's someone that you can actually like make sense with or kind of reason with. You know, obvious people will be critical with him, but like... So, I mean, it's one example.
Yeah, before I derail you on your thing, it's like, obviously now, it's sort of, creeps in a bit, like it's heavily based on experience. Obviously, experience is not the major factor, probably drive and other things, but the major thing here, which I'm sensing, is experience. But now, how long did it take him to get to that experience? Meaning, if we take someone else, no education, whatever, same position, and give him the same experience, will he be in the same position?
Yeah, or was there, for every position where he rose up, was there no other person more qualified than him that could have done a better job at that time, but because he was more connected at that time, he got the job? Is he the best output of the process?
But yeah. The being connected is part of the process.
Yeah.
Well, I think the being connected part questions the fact that in the same, to what degree is the process yielding? The assumption would be that part of your ability to be a good politician and competent politician is to rise up the ranks through building connections.
Mm-hmm.
But we understand that in a plutocratic society like we live in, the playing grounds are not fair. If you're born into wealth, you are significantly more likely to get to power with less input from you.
Independently. I was watching a show before you guys came in, you know? They said something interesting. They said, it's like different people, weird people, right? They sort of, like, I think it was about doctors, yes. They sort of like, okay, if he was saying, as a doctor, every doctor comes in first day of the job, everyone expects some level of competency. Right, they agree on that. They assume you are there, right? But you, as the weird person, define weird whatever, right? In that story, the person has autism, right? So, meaning when they come in, they don't assume he's competent. So he spent his life or most of his life trying to fit in
because he had autism.
Yes. So whether you say black person, whatever the case may be. Some people, they spend most of their life trying to fit in, while others, they assume to be competent from there. They work, they spend most of their life trying to get up. We, black people, whatever, majority or weird people, whether you have some disease, whether you have some whatever, you spend most of your life trying to fit in. So it takes you longer to get to a certain thing because
they're trying to prove that
shit here, guys. But exactly. While other people, they're here, and they run. Even though probably they're worse than you, but because everyone assumes that they're competent, boom.
Yeah. Yeah. But on that question, Papuzo is saying, if there was someone also in his, in let's say, Stone Wilson's position, right? When they're going to do a better job. For me, I always look at my life as well. I'm like, sometimes I go through life, I'm like, yes, I could have done something better here. And I feel like if someone else was in my position, they would have reached a different decision or a better decision, right? Sometimes I'm aware of those things, sometimes I'm not aware. So I feel like to some extent that's also like, might not be a fair analysis or rather a fair question to ask if, okay, is there someone can do better? Because I'm pretty sure if there's someone also in Fabrizio's position and with your resources and everything, they can also actually do a better job than what you do.
Someone who,
you see? So like, there's always like someone
can do better. Always someone can do better.
Well, I mean, the basic thing here, I mean, is that it was more to bring to light the fact that you arguing that he rose to the ranks, and that in itself is evidence of a man that somewhat is competent. And my argument is that really competency, as in the person is capable of doing the job, or has met the requirements of doing the job, or is that purely the basis of somebody who was privileged? And that's the measuring rod here. We're trying to compare people and how competent they are. The evidence that he has risen up, for me, is not enough to suggest that he's competent, because it's clear that if he was privileged, other people who were more competent than him could not have had the chance. And that's why we're having this discussion to begin with, is the fact that we have people in power that we believe are not competent, but yet they get there. So it can't just be because you got there that we assume it's all good. Whether you are an ANC uneducated politician or a DA uneducated politician who appears to be competent because he makes very, very good speeches and is a good chef veep and can say very strong and kind of like, you know, statements that some people believe are very, very intellectual and very, very suggestive of his ability. My argument remains that
that's
like
the evil word, intellectual. You sound intellectual.
Exactly.
Proceed.
I mean, so there's that aspect of it that, you know, I mean, I always remember Shakespeare. I never forgot this theme and it's always stuck with me, and it's probably been the most consistent theme that always flashes back in life wherever. It's that whole theme of, you know, when Macbeth meets the witches, and the witches say, fear is life, and life is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole story behind that was this concept of perception versus reality.
Mm-hmm.
Things are never as they seem. Consistently throughout human nature, we are always faced with a situation where things appear a certain way, but afterwards we realize they were not that way. So a huge chunk of life and dissecting and deconstructing life is being able to realize the difference between how something is seen to be and something it really is. And so I guess, yeah, I mean, like intellectualism and how you speak, what you speak about. Mm-hmm. The fact that I can quote Shakespeare, oh my God, that is another thing that potentially says, oh my God, he's educated, but really? I mean, I got taught that.
Yeah.
Taught to say that if I quote Shakespeare, I'll sound intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
mm-hmm. There
are those aspects of it. And it comes to that question of like, what does it really mean to be really competent?
Really competent, I don't think there's a definition for that. We just need to define what competent is.
Yeah, I think at some point in time, that's why we actually sometimes we come up with this, measurement tools that we use. For instance, we can actually measure you on a scale of 0 to 100, right? And say, okay, if you got like this much, then we say 50%, then you're competent either to progress to the next grade. Because I don't think that there's an absolute measure of competence. For instance, we're in class with Craig. That guy will get 100% in the test and think that the test was easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then Tina will get like 60% and say the test was hard.
Mm-hmm.
Were we competent? Was he more competent? In his eyes, were we actually competent?
Okay.
So like there's that kind of like relative competence, you know. So as well as we met the minimum standards or criteria to go to the next level,
mm-hmm. He
was meeting that over and above the minimum requirements. So like, can he now come and argue and say, now we were not competent because according to his criterion, we think. So I think now when we're actually defining what we mean by competence, I think we need to like somewhat specify the minimum criteria.
It goes to, so currently, obviously in SA, we're currently in this, I want to talk about competence, but using a different topic. We're currently in the state of this thing of metric. Metric results, what they mean, and how are they being judged, and those kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So right now, obviously, all these educated people who went to UCT, went to Vers,
yeah, time to hate.
Yes, you know, they're like, no, they know we have 30% pass rate, whatever the case, da da da.
Which is pathetic.
Like, yeah, like, what do we mean by that, obviously, as a country? It's like, we're saying to pass maths, you need, what, 25% or something like that? To pass English, you need this, da da da. So, what does it mean? Like, is that is that the definition of competence in that level?
Yeah.
Is it okay? Is it not okay? Why should we move it up? Why should we move it down? Those kind of stuff. And then the one I've read today is like, the actual numbers are based on what the DSA, the actual numbers is 49 or 45%. Pass rate.
Just the DA to
so far because like I took
the homework because like the national published numbers is 78%. Yeah, so they're like no, the real numbers is 49 or whatever, something stupid like that. So what? And we know, we definitely know as the human beings in this so-called South Africa, we know that okay, cool. Every year, results get pumped up by some margin, whether it's like 10% sometimes, or it's 20% sometimes, we know that happens. But when it happens, like, how do we feel about it as a country? Sometimes we understand why it happens, because like,
well, I mean, to be fair on the government, because I feel like sometimes, I mean the government has its issues, but so like my girlfriend's mother works in the Department of Education, and she once described what happens. So basically, yes, what happens is that they go about and they probably mark and they realize, oh shit, like 30% of them or 70% of them are failing. All right, now it's going to be a logistical nightmare to fail all 70% of an entire class.
If you do, that's like...
That cannot happen.
Generations and generations and generation of failure. Mm.
And that's why I understand the rationale of government. When they start saying, we might need to bring the pass rate to 30, it's because they're seeing that 80% the devastation of the nation's child are going to fail if we maintain the standard. And that's why the response to that should not just be all like, pathetic, bad government. They don't, how can we do this? The real issue at hand is that it's bad.
Yeah.
And the real response should be more discussion towards like, how do we actually correct the fundamental issue and not just criticize the manner in which the government is dealing with it. So what they do is when they see that 70% of people are failing, then they start saying, okay, cool. It's like what we saw in varsity. They have a bell curve.
And yeah, it's whatever. Called the law of the curve.
Drink, just, yeah. You know, start like adjusting things.
Mm.
All right. So everyone who would have got like 40 suddenly like maybe gets 55. And everyone who would have got, so they start adjusting things to start meeting some idea of what would be a reasonable pass rate.
Yeah.
And that's another honest reality.
If you think about it, right? If based on your example, if 70% of like everyone fails, that's like that's devastation.
Mm.
Like,
yeah.
Because like now, if it's to see, how many generations are going to be affected from it?
Quite a few.
That's a lot.
It's a logistical nightmare.
It's actually funny because, I mean,
And then we're not justifying that they shouldn't do that. But like at that particular time, if I was part of the committee to make some sort of decisions, I'll probably say, cool, let's do something about this because we are there now. We can't fix the because like it's like if you try to fix it in a noble way of saying, like a 0 and 1 way, you're like, no, everyone gets whatever the mark they get.
Mm.
That means another year. That means you've lost how many people?
Thousands of people.
Exactly.
Quite a few.
A lot. Mm. So from a university standpoint, that's a great thing, actually.
Yeah, because I mean,
they from get a country you. Point of view, yeah.
Mm.
So from a country point of view, that's a bad thing.
Mm.
So where do you go from there?
Yeah, it's actually fine because, I mean, obviously, like, last semester I got to lecture. And when you're lecturing, like, even when you're told, like, when you're sitting exams and stuff, you have a criteria. Like, I set an exam for, like, okay, the bare minimum. Everyone should get these questions correct if they were attending classes and did their tutorial, the bare minimum, which is 50%. Then the next 20%, i.e., like, say, that's, like, 70% now, you should be gotten by people who are actually putting a little bit more effort. So, like, we kind of, like, set them gradually that... But I like sometimes
it reminds me of a lecture called his name was Bro. That's pretty much how he says, like, if you attend my classes, you will get this much. Just attend it. If you are above average a bit, you're here. Exactly. If you're excellent, this question literally used to tell you this question was for that kid.
Yeah, it's not for you. Yeah, you see this?
Just ignore it. This question is not for you.
I mean, that's what I also do, right? For me, I call it a punch, right? So when I'm starting, I'm just like, you're getting warmed up, right? But like the more we go, like, you're just getting that like excitement, right? But like if we go further and further, like, you know, I'm kind of trying to separate now the cream from everything else, you know. So like it's one of those things whereby there are several reasons why everyone cannot fail. Like number one, they told me that at least this amount of people should pass, which in our case was like 70%. We need at least 70% of people should be able to comfortably make it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I always tell people that whenever your final mark is 48 on your transcript, we try to put you over 50 and we failed. And that's why I always tell my students that, guys, you should actually try and answer every question. Because when I go back to read, I say, okay, yeah, I'm like on 48. Maybe let me see if I can give you a 2 marks.
Yeah, no, like for me as well, obviously, I was a tutor at some point. So those things you get to them, right? Where you're like, okay, cool, you got a 48. Let me look for marks for you. Even like lectures, they told me that, like, dude, I looked at your script there. I looked for those marks. Yeah. I couldn't find any.
Oh, shit. You failed.
No, because they do. Literally, they do. Even maths lecturers used to tell us that. Like, I looked for marks. I couldn't get them. So here you are. And then you have evil lectures with like, yes, they don't even try. Yes, cancel.
49.5 is not 50.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So,
you guys, you have to understand that. That's why he taught his students that whatever you think, just write something, right? Because whatever you write is actually relative to the question.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to find something.
Yeah, time. But even when you do write, there's only so much they can scrape.
Yeah,
so that's true. But like sometimes someone just
writes utter bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, utter nonsense, at least for the case of the coding.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes I'm like, yeah, man, like there's no way I can justify you giving you a mark.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I can actually go and say, actually, let's say maybe someone writes like a comprehension trying to explain to me what a derivative is, which was, let's say, 10 marks. And I initially given you about 3. I can actually go and say, actually, you chunked in this word. Let me give you a mark for this word.
Mm-hmm.
So I can actually justify and then maybe like put a note there. Actually, this is what you should have expanded it to. But like for the effort, you know, you kind of grant you some marks. But at some point in time, like someone just writes something that is completely out of the loop that I'm like, even me, it looks bad on me. Because they are moderators as well. So it kind of looks bad on you as well as a thing.
But true. I mean, I guess like when you forget like the work, the marks, the stats, you remember that, okay, you've got a university institution. It has so many lectures that can take so many students. So in first year, you've got NSLT, you've got Big Leslie Social, 2A and 2B. And come second year, they can't have the same number of people in second year as they had in first year. So right from just the basic fundamentals, you're always going to need to maintain a certain failure rate across the board. So I think that already sets a tone where there's just already so much that a university or an institution can do to like get people to pass.
Yeah.
And I guess
Reynolds was saying that, obviously, firstly, it's like a lot of you guys were not meant to be here, but you're here. Because what
the government, we got a lot of A's, right?
The government changed the rules, and then a bunch of you guys are here.
Oh shit,
you're not meant to be here.
Yeah, 2008, you were the first to try the new syllabus.
Yes. You wanna
and
leave.
A lot of us got A's.
Yes,
and then people went and did AXI and all sorts of things.
You like,
so oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so we were the first to do it.
Really?
And then we came in with a lot of A's.
Yeah, a lot of A's.
See, that we were like the third, and we did it in 2010, actually. Because I remember that, I think to some extent we also passed because of the World Cup, because like we guys didn't have time. So I feel like our exams were somewhat mildly manageable. You know,
okay, so going back to the government thing, like, what do you want?
Well, see, now, when you think of the government thing, is obviously, I mean, the government fucks up and fails in many levels, but I feel like what's more worth talking about is the fundamental problem that they faced. They clearly maybe are not addressing it the correct manner, but there's a bigger question to ask, is how do you fix this nightmare? Why are we here? Why is education so shitty? Why is it that a country like Zimbabwe, with less GDP,
less resources,
less stability, less everything, but you're not able to produce high school kids that are more educated, whatever that even means.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's this broader, bigger question to address. I mean, you've got the IEB that produced 98% pass rate. No one ever really questions that.
Yeah.
I mean, we always kind of like agree that that's... So I think there's that issue that... You know, maybe we've spent so much energy about fees must fall and varsity and whatever, when a lot of research suggests that the fundamental failure in our education system is at the high school and primary school level.
Yeah.
How much energy has been invested in the government to fix that? And personally, to cut it short, I agree. Pass them so you save more time to fix the fundamental issue. Failing them all will just create an even bigger social and political problem.
Yeah, on that, right? But like now, since you got to grade one, I think the first time I heard about, was it OEB?
OVE.
OBE.
Outcome-based education.
Grade three?
Yeah,
we heard about that shit our whole lives. I remember
kids. Yeah, so like South Africa in general, they've been trying different things. And then OEB was, I think, was an adaptation from
the UK.
The UK. It failed there. And then the I remember Nare Padno justified, it's like, okay, it failed there, correct, but we're different here.
Right.
We'll adapt it in some way, and then we'll make it work here. It failed as well.
Right.
And then, so they kept on changing things to what level, like, at what point are we going to say, okay, cool, let's adopt something stupid. Stupid, whatever stupid means,
Let's take something from Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is successful in that department. Why can't you just take copy-paste?
Yeah, I think there's also one question, one fundamental difference. I'm going to first make a comment about why our stuff is also messed up and no one is trying to fix it. Because I remember
they are trying to fix it. They are failing.
To some extent they are failing, but I don't think the efforts are really concentrated than maybe in varsity. I remember
varsity protest and created a social political problem.
That's something else, but it goes back to our conversation of intelligence or having governmental leaders who are intelligent.
I think for me, to some extent, we actually do have those. I remember a comment that one lady once made at one of the UN meetings, because we have lots of people, companies, government, and everyone. And we're actually asking a question, why can't we fix these issues at grassroots levels? And this lady was like, guys, I'm going to be blunt with you. Grassroots level is just messy, and no one wants to get their hands dirty. So we have brilliant people, we have capabilities, but because it's so messy, no one really want to go there, down there, and try and sort out that thing. So that's number one. And the second thing is...
So no one is willing to go to primary level and fix.
Exactly.
Then they just want to be on the happy state, which is...
They want to get you.
So everyone's focusing on grade 10 and grade 12. Grade 10 to grade 12.
I would say actually mostly post-matric. They want to come here when you're already going to varsity and everything. Actually, then they give you a bursary. Then they start providing you mentorship and all that thing. I mean, that's what like companies do,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure.
So there's more funding for all these kids and mentorship and all that stuff. That's what they want to do.
Yeah, that's a different topic for another day, because this bursary shit...
Of course, they're questionable, but like, yeah, but you can see that they get you to a point where after, like, you've done. Because for instance, they can say...
Well, bursaries like, normally would be, they just give you something, or they look for, who is it, based on their... they need to give you something so that they can get their taxes correctly, right? That's what I'm saying. That's a topic for another day.
But then the second thing as well is that in South Africa, is there a culture of education, intellectualism, i.e. is education sexy? Because when I look at these other countries, you can see, like, for instance, I spent a whole lot of time with, like, niggas from Zim, right?
At break, like, a friend of mine once told me, Uti, like, he, like, you know, Tifo, right? Tifo, hard worker and stuff like that, obviously, UCT, like, no, UCT students. And then afterwards, like, you go home, when you get home, you see someone who didn't graduate or do, like, he didn't go to any fancy university, they probably left matric, whatever the case may be. And then they're driving a Beamer or they're driving a Golf, blah, 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 blah. And then a young kid, like a young, probably 6, 7, 10 year old, and then he sees you, he's like, "Ah, uncle, so when you went to school, but you're not driving anything, but this guy didn't go to school and he's driving something." No, how do you answer that?
It's kind of fun. That's what I'm saying.
And also, you can't go all educated, like, it's about the long term. It's a kid.
Exactly. This is what I'm saying, that culture of intellectualism being sexist, it's not there. And even one of those, I remember, like when you come after first year, you're going to podcasting, you're trying to advise guys, no, we're afraid to know, do this and that. Like, oh, so now you're from UCT, ne? You think you're now clever than us, ne? So it's one of those things where, like, I'm not sure if you guys have ever tried to actually reach out to people podcasting.
I remember I used to
no, you can't do that, actually.
Oh,
no,
okay.
Don't read too much, you're going to go crazy.
Every time I go,
you know, like, and then you get those things, so you're overqualified. I'm like, what do you mean by overqualified? I don't even know a quarter of things that I should be knowing about this world. But what do you mean I'm overqualified? So you get those things.
The fact that you're advising them.
Yeah, so you get those things whereby that thing isn't seen as sexy. People don't see, like, education, intellectualism, learning as sexy, you know. I know you're gonna go crazy, you're overqualified, you're this and that, you know. So, like, those are some of the issues that we actually face within our society.
I think there's something else to deconstruct. We've assumed that Zimbabwe has got it right. But it just hit me that Zimbabwe uses A-levels. It's not a Zimbabwean system. It's a British system.
It doesn't.
So it's a colonial system which the British brought in at that time. They've just continued to practice.
I'm trying to understand the relevance.
The relevance I'm trying to get is that Zimbabwe didn't actually build up an education system from scratch on their own.
And how is that relevant?
It's relevant because
like when based we on praise them, should we say
no, but can't you actually Africa, adopt the same?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. South Africa is trying to get an education system that works.
Now, the natural question would be, or maybe say the natural answer would be that the A-level system is at a standard that if you were to try and implement it now, you'd have a drastic transition period that might result in this number of failures. It's almost like realizing that you're an alcoholic.
But
and
that's what I'm assuming that what that's what happened with us. We are first generation. If we fail a lot, and then they make some calibration that year, and then hoping that the conservative years,
they make up for it.
Thank you. So, but for us, it seems like every fucking year there's some margin they add.
Yeah, it seems like, but the thing is, you all have gotten more stupid after us.
Yeah. Okay, everyone is somehow saying that, huh?
You know,
I don't think so. Hey.
It was like easy now, yeah, and then suddenly, why are you all struggling?
No, like the papers are better.
But without you, there was no reference.
No, exactly. No, more references. Exactly. Not having reference, they sort of give you leeway. So if you look at it, we have reference from
we had those exemplars.
Yeah,
to be honest, for a lot of exams, if you went to the exemplar,
yeah,
their final papers were yes. Literally
and then exactly the thing like before. Them. Well, you had a thing before exams. What do you call it?
Prelims.
Yeah. Oh, yes, we have that.
Yeah.
But beside that, right? I want to say something. I forgot. Continue. I'll remember it.
Well, okay, cool. I guess that, okay, cool. Fair and fine. All right. There's a transition period towards fixing any system. Mm. And the worst problem is trying to break down some aspect of the system and not replacing it with something that is obviously better than what was there before.
Mm.
So the real honest question is that what should our government actually do? All right. And my proposition is that
yes, I remember my point. My point was more on like, okay, cool. So that thing of saying our year was fine, and later on people sort of failing. But like I've looked at the papers before, like a last year paper, for example. Just have a look at it and see.
Like physics, maths.
Those two. Look at them. I was like, cool. Which topics do you know, or like you haven't seen before? There's a bunch. There's new topics in there, or there's the same topic but now on a higher level, because I've seen them like, okay, I can solve this at ease. This is a new topic for me. How do I go about it? Probably the same topic but now on a higher level. So I think they've calibrated going up. That's what I've acknowledged for me, like from trigonometry, finance, not really. But yeah, things have been going up a bit.
Yeah, cool. I haven't looked at the matric papers, to be honest, since I left. Yeah. But what I'd like to imagine, though, is that on a political level, I mean, the unfortunate reality is that a lot of things go into education beyond just the need to try and get people to pass and excel and be good academics.
The fundamental need to also meet
some kind of like logistical, as we've spoken about it, and even just political outcome. So the ANC government has an incentive to make sure that the kids pass. And what I'd like to believe is that
on there before
they sit in that
why
year,
are you specifically mentioning ANC government? Why did you say government? Why emphasizing on the ANC
government? Well, it's technically the ANC government. That's
but he said it, so he probably has that reason.
Well, the main reason I want to put it is because remember, we're dealing with political narratives here. I mean, whenever we're questioning the government and the results, and what's on the table is this accusation that the government has somehow rigged and bumped and twisted things to try and make themselves look good so that they can be voted back in. So mentioning the ANC government is just a reference to the fact that, okay, cool, that's the government of today. Calling it government is almost like, you know, like, yeah, it's just abstracting a layer of detail, which I think is already there on the table. You've got an ANC government that's in control. And more specifically, you've got the opposition parties, predominantly.
But government is government, regardless whether it's ANC or not.
True, in theory. But in practice, a government is pretty much led by people who are operating along certain ideals and ideas.
Yeah.
And predominantly, you're dealing more with a party than you're dealing with government.
Yeah, because sometimes...
Especially in South Africa and the kind of political system that
I guess
have.
Any country, actually. So, because sometimes I used to watch those parliament things. I think they used to happen every Thursday. Now, somehow, they've changed. Like, every Thursday, I used to watch parliament.
Yeah, so it became exciting, actually. That's one thing
with
that
the EFF. No, yeah,
before,
with the EFF.
No, before EFF.
Oh, before the EFF.
Before EFF, I used to watch parliament.
That's deep.
Yeah, I used to watch parliament literally every Thursday, sit down, my laptop, watch parliament, right? So one thing I've realized in there is that people will just oppose for the sake of opposing, not because the thing, the idea, or the policy. Yeah, they just say, because you're ANC and you're gonna make this look good, whatever, I oppose. Yeah, like sometimes you get to that level, like, but why though? That's a good, literally, that's a very good policy. Why are you opposing? Just because you're ANC or DA or EFF, whatever, I oppose.
Yeah.
Probably, yes, once they start making a, that goes back to the Hitler thing, but once you put them on the spot, put a mic in front, then they justify why they're doing that. Then you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Because probably they have underlying reasoning behind that. They'll tell you, no, I know this is not only about this. It connects to this and this and this and that. That's why I opposed it. And then you're like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah. But if you are there, first time you don't know about the politics, and then they just put that policy in front of you, you'll just vote.
I mean, part of the skill of, like, any, like, successful or respectable politician is the ability to, like, vouch or push for an agenda and find every rational reason for it.
Yeah.
I mean, part of a good politician is to convince you that this is the way, I oppose it for X, Y, and Z, and you actually having enough reason to believe that he was actually valid. I mean, the bottom line is, strip away what they say, the reasoning behind it, and just purely look at it from an agenda-based perspective. He has an agenda to do X, Y, and Z. They have an agenda to do X, Y, Z. Good politicians cover it up and flower it up with some really good reasoning that you swallow up and actually believe. Bad politicians, like what we're probably seeing right now with the ANC, is where it's just so bad that even though, like, the bullshit they're telling you is unbelievable, they're just saying it anyway. You know? So I think that it's about agendas. And from a rational point of view...
Yeah, I wanna poke at something that you said, but because of...
Okay, cool. So let's take 1 minute each to wrap up.
Yeah, I wanna wrap up as well. But now, let's go... I wanna go back to the main thing that we started with, which is politicians. We said intellectual politicians.
Yeah.
What... we want that? If you do want that, how does it look like?
So you have 1 minute.
Yeah. Rapper. For me, I guess somebody else needs to start. Yes.
Okay. For Prince,
yeah.
1 minute. 20 past, so 1 minute.
Okay, cool. I think, like, just like I started, let's remove the whole going to varsity aspect. Let's talk about competent people. We live in a world where we can see a lot more competent people are coming from all sects of life, being able to accomplish and do things. So for me, the bottom line is that you want leaders that are able to fundamentally progress whatever department or thing that they're leading. And that involves being politically smart and not just being obviously intellectually smart. So gone are the days where it's, you know, we always complain that, well, the bad guys in politics and the good guys that should be there are not there. I'll add another layer to pretty much say that part of also being a good politician is having good ideas and being politically smart enough to beat your competitors and implement those good ideas. We've always had to deal with the dichotomy of bad, crooked leaders who are somehow able to kill, steal, destroy to get in power. Why can't the good guys essentially, you know, win the political battle for the ideas that they're vouching? So a competent leader is fundamentally a leader that is able to have those good ideas and also have the political muscle to actually see them through.
Bongs, we are 1 minute.
Okay, I'm like.
For me, in terms of politicians, I just prefer people who can just make up their mind just for the good of the people. Obviously, that doesn't happen often, but that needs to happen. And then, I don't have a lot of things to say about that, but competence or not, for me, competence is knowing what you're trying to do and doing it to the full extent, and then try to educate yourself with other things so you can learn. And then if you made a mistake, learn from that, continue from there, and then for me, that's competence. Yeah.
Okay, my 1 minute starts now. So for me, I don't think that politicians particularly need to be smart intellectually, but I think that they need to be street smart. And by that, I mean that our politicians need to be able to identify the social issues. And then once they identify the social issues, kind of like have a consortium or guys who are smart. That's what they're called. Is it the bureaucracy or those guys who actually implement government policies?
Bureaucracy is just paper.
So they need to actually be able to identify social issues and then also be able to link up that with the people that actually can implement their proposed solutions to particular issues, you know. So I don't think that in and of themselves need to be like, okay, intellectually smart or went to varsity and stuff like that. I don't think that varsity is a requirement for a good politician, but I think that social intelligence is actually a good requirement for a politician. So be socially smart, find issues, and then go and look for people that actually can implement solutions to those issues. Yeah, my minute is up, so we can stop.
So, like, being like, just be willing to get smarter people to do your job.
Precisely.
Well, yeah. Where I disagree with that before.
Before you disagree, I agree with him, but I think, like, okay, political way, right? The president should be somebody who is street smart. Like, really, you should be like really street smart, as you say. Okay. But then the person advising him has to be like super smart.
Okay. Yeah. Advice, obviously, as a president, you're expecting to be being advised by a gazillion people.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. A president shouldn't really be smart, like educated and shit. He should like know real life. And then have somebody who's spent their life studying shit. Advising them or
but
telling
when,
them what
when,
to do.
When you are when you're outside your comfort zone, when you're in a different country, different city, it's only you.
No, but they go with their advisors, huh?
When they do.
Events, but before you go, I think you get those meetings whereby those people know where you're going and they tell you what you should expect when you get there.
Yeah. Like for me, prisons are useless in my head.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Do nothing, but they are more serenim. What's the word?
Ceremonial.
That word. They just
The first thing is I kind of disagree this is like
we have two more minutes.
This is like the traders. For one,
sure.
The concept of street smart, I think, is an outdated concept.
Yeah.
It comes from an age where guys who studied were nerds and were out of touch with reality, and they read books, and we assume that they were out of touch with the realities at the bottom. In today's world, we've got guys from Soweto who are able to go to UCT and get degrees. They are completely aware of what's happening on the streets, and they are completely exposed and aware of what's happening academically.
Yeah.
Then there's a question of, like, if that really was the case, why not have the intellectual in power and him be advised by the street smart people? Why an emphasis on the street smart person, whatever that even means, being informed by the somehow naive but only intellectual person? So my view is that we can have street smart people that are intellectual. In today's world, a street person or supposed street person has the ability to have access to formal education. Part of formal education is also the ability to study the real world, to study how real people live. And we trust that even more than just people's personal experiences, because those could be biased. We want to have people who have studied the realities on the ground. That's where sociology comes in. That's when understanding the logic of what people say. And lastly, my fundamental issue with this dichotomy between smart and uneducated, Singapore, China, countries, third world countries that move from high dependency countries, like dependent on the West, to being independent countries that have a belt ecosystem. A major move that they did is that they got a lot of professionals, more specifically Singapore, all their politicians were engineers. And we see cases of that where, you know,
but we South Africa is different because South Africa was like that until to a point now, all scientists and engineers fucked up and then people don't trust them anymore. It was like that before.
No, what do you mean?
Change. Continue, proceed, proceed, proceed.
Like, I mean, our apartheid government, I mean, that's a whole different ballgame.
Okay, because, we need to...
If you talk about, obviously, like, our government now, we've never really adopted that view. And my argument is that countries, third world countries that have transitioned to become first world countries or moving there, have adopted this radical view of getting more professionals to lead government.
Okay.
Yeah, so for me, my two last words, like UCT, like being exposed to UCT, I like the word exposed because I'm just exposing people to different things. Being exposed to UCT, the environment, talking to different people, having different thoughts of how to do things, it's sort of too much like I went from 0 to 100 just for being around UCT. So I don't know if that's education or not. Like, that's excluding
what I've been learning. Yeah, that's what I call externalities, right?
Yeah, but the main thing, what made me as Bongani, is not the courses. It's everything outside the courses.
That's true.
Which has made me to be who I am right now. Yes, the courses, they help you to persevere and, you know you're a pusher. I'm a pusher. Like, it doesn't matter what I fail or not. I want to get to the point. So that sort of solidified that, but the main thing is, if I didn't get to UCT, I wouldn't be the person I am right now, because I see it every time I go home. The way I think is fucking different.
Precisely.
So I don't know if that's education or not, or that's obviously part of. If you talk to like big people, they'll tell you university is about like the there's the education, but mostly. Talking to
exchange of ideas
and talking to people who are like coming from different environments,
the cultural capital,
exactly, just to build that in you.
Yeah,
fair enough, I can get that, but can we just probably that's what they're exposed to a lot, because now you have online universities. Because I was listening to some debate about why don't you just go to like that thing
online is cheaper, but then there's the thing, they don't get to meet the people. Because for me, like
major universities, they specialize on a certain thing of trying to build you up.
Exactly. So it's more, for me, it's more about the camaraderie. For instance, if I was in Smart, I wouldn't have met Fabrice, I wouldn't have met Bongani, right? But and because of that setting whereby you actually institutionally come together and actually get to mingle and exchange ideas. Right now we're sitting here, I'm an economist and finance by training, you're an engineer. But you're actually discussing a sociology type of based question, right? It's because of that camaraderie that you have built and that exchange of knowledge that we can actually engage within these topics, you know?
Yeah, which is another thing which I don't know how it affects this whole thing, but
yeah. Okay. Engineering. So I called the cab and it's arrived. Okay, cool.
Engineering, why so did you call a cab now though? We have mentioned drink.
No, we're working on a downtown thing.
No, you should have just told us.
Yeah, we can tell. Stop.
We can remove that last bit.
Stop. But yeah, dude, you should have.
Yeah, cool. Okay, let's
cancel it.
Okay, I've cancelled it. But my idea was that we're going to take this to town.
I have a work towards my master's at the same time. And then there's the other side where it is like it's mostly on the down moments that you miss the old ways of doing things.
Yeah, I mean, there is something crazy about this whole experiment that we're running called trying to be it all and have it all. And
yeah.
I guess for women, I suppose it's always the ideal of being that so-called super mom where you can have a career that's vibrant and you're there leading meetings. And at the same time, you're home cooking for your kids and attending and being the soccer mom, you know, like, and yeah, and I don't know. I mean,
like, but it's such a new trend. I mean, like, remember how, like, I mean, we went through campaigns and everyone didn't know she was pregnant until the baby came. And then not even a month later, she was up and running. She's on now and done the same thing. Now Lo Yuso, who was on a daily doing door to door, you know, posting on social media and stuff, shocked all of us, the whole world. On Saturday had a baby shower. Like, she's 5'2" Jew. And everybody's applauding her. Wow, oh, you're such a superwoman. It's like such a thing. Whereas the whole the traditional wife, that's like a complete taboo. Like, by that time.
But that's a subtle thing I've also picked up about, if I can put it in inverted commas, the so-called feminist movement, whichever way it's articulated and people perceive it. To what degree has the fact that some people, because it's not everyone, aspire to have a certain idea of what it means to be a woman, what it means to be progressive, etc. To what degree are you now also starting to shame other women who might not agree with your definition of progress?
Too many.
And some women now will feel like they are backward. I mean, to what degree?
In fact, I feel like the first people they call out is women before they call out not progressive men. They're harsher on each other than they are men, I feel. Especially the staunch feminists. You know, suddenly you hear things like, I'm so shocked. Some girl decides to boycott our Reclaiming the Night rally, saying that she just does not subscribe to that kind of feminism. I was like, what's that? Like,
yeah, I know. You've got some really interesting, exotic versions of things out there. And I guess everyone is entitled to have their own cocktail of ideas. But what I think and what I fear more is, I just felt like the problem to some degree of patriarchy, which is another issue, because let me get your opinion, Julie.
Mm-hmm.
I've started realizing that a lot of women are actually patriarchal in the sense that they actually subscribe to a role where they as a woman play a patriarchal role. And it seems more
that, what do you mean they're playing a patriarchal?
Like, it seems more that, if I can be more practical and break it down, it seems more that a lot of women actually don't have a fundamental problem with the fact that there's a man and that they are submitting to that man, and that that man is almost like their head, their leader, etc., etc. They're the follower, essentially, if I can just summarize it to a leader-follower relationship in a general sense.
There's nothing wrong in a relation where, in different roles or in different aspects, one needs the other follows, one needs the other follows. The notion of when it becomes patriarchal is when it becomes a traditionally defined role, that your place is in the kitchen and my place is on the couch watching TV, reading a newspaper, and you must be barefoot, pregnant, bringing me my meal. It becomes, so basically I think the fundamental word is, once it becomes oppressive, once the gender roles or the roles between two people become oppressive in nature, like, so I would want to gift you or cook for you because I want to do something nice for you, but once it becomes my job, to an extent where I must probably leave work to cook for you, or to an extent where I'm sick and I must get up and cook for you because it's my job, then that's where the lines are completely blurred.
But then the interesting question would be then, is it that there's something wrong inherently with patriarchy, or the abuse of power by men in a patriarchal system? Is it that women are complaining more that the men are abusing their power, or that you have a fundamental problem with them having that, sitting on that power seat to begin with? Because I feel like it's almost two different things.
Patriarchy is the abuse, the gender, the abuse of a man who's the patriarch over the power.
No, but then
over a woman.
So
a woman is doing something like that in reverse is where it's called matriarchy.
No, but then patriarchy and matriarchy are not fundamentally defined by the oppressive
attributes.
They are.
It if you go back traditionally, if you look at the dictionary definition of patriarchy, it's not necessarily fundamentally about the fact that there's a man who's oppressing a woman. It's more about the fact that there's a societal structure where men are always at the top. The Bible is patriarchal.
That's you've got God, you've got whatever. Structure.
But it doesn't fundamentally imply that it's always... There's almost a case to be made for benevolent patriarchy.
Those roles.
There's a...
So if you see those roles, in the male dominance in society and of things and of everything else, there's a fundamental underlying of abuse and oppression. And that's the reason why it's called out. If it was not oppressive, if it was a kumbaya situation, it was great. The world would have had nothing wrong with it.
But don't you think that...
The problem is that it became oppressive and it became repressive, if I couldn't say that. So a woman cannot go and work in certain jobs, cannot occupy senior management positions and so forth and so on and etc. Because... of the fact that she's a man or he's a man and she's a woman.
But there are some who might argue or see it differently. There are some who might say actually that no, in a proper patriarchal system, whatever way you want to put it, as a man, my intention is, if you look at just the basic, even biblical notion, that as a woman, as a man, your job is to love your woman to the point that you're willing to die for her.
Yeah.
But that woman must submit to you. So it's more that there's a case to be made that there's a benevolence role that a man ought to play, the benevolent dictator in a patriarchy. It's not fundamentally oppressive. And
it is.
Here's a question to me. Here's my question to you. There's also a culture where, especially you see it between the left and the right. Now, if you're on the one side of the agenda, you ideologically defined things that might be generic or fundamental to what the other side views as inherently oppressive in order to justify the destruction of that ideology. A classic case is, for example, when you look at like how the homosexuality discussion goes. It's like there's no in-between. You're either like, I'm pro homosexuality in terms of like, I ideologically believe in it, it's all fine, everyone can... you know, do or be whatever they want to be, or you're Adolf Hitler. There's no room to say that, okay, you can be whoever you want to be. I don't believe you should be thrown in jail or oppressed. You can do whatever the hell you want, but I still want to maintain my ideological right to not subscribe to a gender ideology that you do. I might still feel like it is a sinful thing, but do you? I'm not going to put you in jail. There's almost this thing that on the one side, you define anyone who just does not agree with your framework as inherently evil to fulfill your agenda of also destroying the entire ideological framework. So there's some that might believe there's a case for patriarchy where it's not fundamentally oppressive and it can be good as long as the men don't abuse their power.
How would it not be? Why must it be that one gender that your biology must determine? That you make the decision, as opposed to it being about the collective. Like, why must it be a structured role play type of situation? I always give the example of like two married couples, and I always say, like, if we wake up, you know that my character, I take longer to get up, but you wake up early. You can wake up and iron our clothes, and I go and I take longer in the shower, but I know that once I'm out, I can go warm the cars whilst you make breakfast. So it's based on our characters, our personalities, and we model it. And it is not based on a role that should be. And one of the guys was just like, ha! You know, and stuff, what do I say to my mother when she comes? I'm like, or my father when he comes and sees us. I'm like, that's where the fundamental problem is that once traditional roles of what things should be and should not be, you know, and stuff, become an issue that it inconveniences it does not, oh, yeah, I don't know whether inconvenience is alright, but it does not accommodate your way of doing things and your way of life, it becomes a problem. So my view, by the way, on homosexuality is that what I think it's a sin, like drinking, like I mean, as in like getting drunk, like killing and so forth. I don't think the person is a social pariah. I think their actions are a problem. And therefore, they should not be stoned to death, you know, and stuff for being homosexual. They should be treated in the same way that you treat a murderer, or you treat a druggie or whatever not, because they're committing a sin. So therefore, you welcome them in a church and pray for them that they would obviously change their ways. That's how I see it being treated. And the problem is that now you begin to oppress this person because they have a different sexual orientation. That is wrong. That's oppressive.
No, it's interesting. To what degree, though, like if you look at how you have classified the problem of patriarchy, like to what degree is that unique to patriarchy? Any worldview, including the one that you are articulating, that you want, which some might argue is a very, let's say, individualistic view, given that in as much as you can be an individual, but a lot of individuals choose to subscribe to a lot of these cultural practices. A lot of women, surprisingly, even if you gave them the choice, would still prefer to live in conditions where they actually have men take the lead on a lot of things. And that's, for me, has always been the surprising thing, is that in as much as we hear a lot of this kickback that women want to, let's say, have equal power, etc., etc., but in actual fact, a lot of women are actually still socialized, from one perspective, to submit to a patriarchal system. But on the other side, you also see that, who's to say that for thousands of years, human beings have lived a certain way? And it's only in this generation that we kind of like wake up and we somehow believe that all of that is bullshit and we want to live life a certain way and the rules must change. I mean,
in fact, that's where you're wrong. Patriarchy is probably 19th century new problem. In the past, we had female chiefs, female queens, females, warriors.
But is this globally or is just in one specific culture? Because, I mean, we still have the Bible, which is like thousands of years, and the Bible is very patriarchal. But that's like 1% or 2% of the amount of characters.
It's not as told, but I look at it in the context of we had more female chiefs, we had more female, and in fact, a notion of a patriarchy, of placing a woman's role under a man, I think is something that was brought by colonialism. That's really something
really?
I would argue. Because the biggest war people who fought in Africa, for example, the biggest people who fought against colonial rule for the longest of time in Africa were female chiefs, female queens, female queen mothers, and so forth. There's historical tales of it in Ghana, in Ethiopia, and so forth. I had a whole research done that I did and put it together for an address I was making, and I actually realized that. And because of it, it's the same way in which colonialists have over time led us to believe that white people are far superior and are better than black people, like where people shake when they see a white person. I think it's in the same way that they've redefined the role of a woman. So the mistake that we make is we make submission to be an opposite to equality. When you're asking for equality, it's automatically written off as not refusing to submit, which is not the case. All they're saying is that there should be equality in opportunity. So and that's the problem with a male-dominated world, or with patriarchy, is that the roles are such that women always remain the subservient, but actually are the ones who are doing most of the work. And basically, the whole thing is saying, let there be equal work for equal pay, equal rights, equal opportunity. So women aren't asking to be men. Women aren't asking, you know, stuff to carry heavy loads and whatever not. Women are just saying, I want the opportunity, you know, and stuff, if I want to climb up a pole, you know, as a construction worker, and it should be okay. And it shouldn't be that, no, because I'm born female, therefore I'm not allowed to climb.
But how do you account for some of the biological facts about our differences and how they translate into our capabilities
I will climb the pole until I'm going to take maternity leave. And then I will take maternity leave.
Okay, so, but that's like for pregnancy. But like, if you, in our modern day, it's very easy to like, the distinctions disappear very quickly. But if you go back in time where you needed to hunt, and I mean, it's a biological fact that males, because
the Bible actually speaks of women, the Proverbs 31 actually make women the hunters. The hunters for food.
Let's lay down something. Here's a question I also want to ask. I feel like sometimes, and I see the black movement does it too. Sometimes it's like when you have been oppressed and disadvantaged, there's almost this sense where one wants to overrepresent the positive aspects of the oppressed in order to, as a fight back against whatever the narrative or the oppressor is. It's like how suddenly everything smart and bright and brilliant was black. All science was made by black people. And I feel like...
But those are the facts.
No, the reality is that God did not just create black people. God created a whole diverse range of people. But I feel like in our attempt to try and reaffirm ourselves, we overdo it by somehow also not realizing that, yeah, we have value, but other people have value too. It's not true that we are the only one that are valuable. They have value,
everybody is valuable. Exactly. Everybody is valuable, so, but the problem is that the historical line has been written by those who have been in charge, and those who have been in charge have been white, and they've written the historical line to favor them. And unfortunately, the black line have not been writing as much of their tale.
But
that's,
you know,
why they keep having to come out and keep saying, but actually, I'm the one who actually...
But you know what the challenge is when the black come out, is that now as a black person, I mean, you grew up for years, and I mean, knowing Dad, I followed conspiracy theories quite extensively growing up. And one of the problems I realized is that when there's an established truth and there's this, the new guy coming to challenge the established truth that they're lying to, here's the real truth, we have no way of validating these alternative truths.
That's
because they stand on, they stand on the one principle that they're trying to hide it from you. I'm revealing you the truth. But how do I validate that even this new truth that you are trying to bring out is not over-exaggerated, that it is valid? There's no validation matrix around alternative truth, because everybody's leveraging on the fact that they're lying to you and I'm bringing you the real truth. That's the challenging part with conspiracy and things that dwell in the alternative realm. They might be true, they might not be true. How do I know? How do I check? It's not everyone who says that, oh no, this fact happened, or oh no, whatever. And when you try and challenge it, it's like, oh no, it's because you've been brainwashed by the system. You know, they're trying to... And it's like, that's... How do you validate that there were actually more female warriors than male warriors, or they were not the same,
the
or there were some...
There. The research is there. It's coming out. The research is there. But archaeologists are bringing up
there's always research to the contrary.
There's a history to it. The history is something that, and the research can't be ignored. There's no one who's actually denied these facts to be true.
To be honest, I personally, okay, I mean, that's the thing about the new world we live in when it comes to ideas, is that we can all be living in almost like different ideological and fact universe. And that was the problem. That's what this new digital and almost fake news and whatever world has done, is that someone can live in a certain ideological worldview and believe their facts and research and probably have a lot of snippets of it to substantiate it, and someone live in a completely different paradigm and believe their facts, and then they look at each other and they both call each other fake news with facts and research. That's the world we live in, actually.
The world of yes, fake news is growing, but the world of research, authentic research that you do through these institutions and so forth, is tested, is tried, is
well, not necessarily. There's
research that denies the facts, and there's research that agrees with the facts. But the reality is, you can't ignore it. It's there. When you look, the person explains how they did a surgery, for example, versus the actual person who claimed to have won it. The person who's explaining how they did it speaks more truth. And that's how you're able to believe it, that actually this black person is the real owner of this shit, and not this person who's claiming the tribe.
I guess the challenge is there. Even in science, I mean, I've been listening to a lot of the basically, depending on what you believe, there's been this kickback that is starting to show that even scientific research is biased along funding lines. Basically, we know that academics rely on funding. And for a long time, which is one of the big issues with global warming now, there's been a lot of funding that has been going to promote the concept of global warming, the earth is going dark, etc., etc., in order to justify and pump up green technology, etc., etc. And there's lots of conspiracy theories and a lot of actual people coming out and questioning this whole global warming vibe, because now there's new truths that are coming out, new papers are being written to show the alternative. So even in the academic world, we know that there are challenging ideas, and even in academia, they're not all the same. Telling me about Newton's law and the thing that falls from the sky is not the same as a lot of more opinionative stuff that would be based on certain theories that might be peer-reviewed, but even then you have conflicting views. We have conflicting views about creation. We have conflicting views about evolution. So it's like to just pull out research and say, okay, cool, there's X. They're even in that world, there's a lot of researchers and they're all producing different research and injecting different opinions in it.
The notion of let a thousand schools of thought, let a thousand flowers bloom and a thousand schools of thought contend. And he who has the most highest, in a democratic world, he who has the highest numbers of views or believers in relation to their school of thought is the one that is the winner. In a dictatorship, he who rules all.
But is that valid though? That if the majority of people subscribe to your way of seeing things, it somehow makes your way of seeing things probably more correct than the other. Is that really a?
It doesn't say that it could be ethically correct. We could all be wrong about having voted for Cyril. Majority could be wrong about having voted for someone, and he actually could be a drunkard and a thing. But in a democratic society, that's what happens. It makes it correct in the sense that it becomes about the freedoms and the wills of people.
But we all know that democracy isn't necessarily perfect.
In a democratic society, in a dictatorial society, whoever is the Führer or the ruler will decide for all of you. And there's also ethical barriers to it, because what says that one person knows what's best for 50 people, or 500 people, or 5,000 people, you know? So those have been contending in society for years. I, at some point, actually believe dictatorship is the way to go.
Plato,
in
his work, that's where the term benevolent dictator, that he argues that the best system is a system where you have a benevolent dictator.
Yeah.
And sadly, when you look at history, and it might sound wrong quoting these people, but people like Nelson Mandela, the guys like Gaddafi
is a perfect example of a dictator.
Well, I guess.
But there was progress. Libya was the wealthiest. Libya was funding the entire African continent. Libya was moving towards building a United States of Africa. Libya was on a high. So that's the thing of it. You know, those who were closer to Mandela actually speak of him being a serious dictator. He'd pick up the phone like 5 minutes before you go into the meeting and say to you, you will not stand. You will not avail yourself for this job. You will not get it. You know, and like he was just harsh and horrible. And in fact, if they gave him 2 terms, he'd be, people would have hated him just like all the, they've done with Zuma, they've done with Mbeki, and all of that. So it's different systems. So for me, I think what's at the fundamental of it is the allowing the will, giving people the free will to decide what's best for them, versus people subjecting their, or handing over their free will to an individual to decide for them what's best for them. So those are the contending things.
That, but do you agree that on some things, people might not necessarily always have the best perspective of what's right for them, and it's probably better for someone else to do, like talk to the, something like medicine
group is a perfect example. Those guys can just decide, because it's Judy saying it, all of them will rubbish it because they're affectionate. Whether you're saying the right thing, they just will all say no, and they're a majority, and therefore in a democratic dispensation they're majority rules. And then on the other side of it is, and I would walk away believing that actually I'm giving the, offering the best solution to the problem, and they walk away thinking, ha 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 ha, we just showed you a way to go, you know, and then they'll come to the same conclusion at the end of it, and then you're like, well, at the end of it, what was the point? I think a simple example is their mathematics, and me saying, actually guys, we've not won. We don't have a clear majority. We need to go and get IFP. And all of them, just because they're bitter, you know, a small bitter faction, go on about how, you know, like, you're crazy, you know, and stuff, we've won this thing, your math is wrong. And then 2 hours later, they all come back to the same conclusion to say, actually, guys, we've lost. Actually, guys, we've lost it. I'm like, thank you. You know. Like, so that's the problem with the mob versus
you also notice that there's almost this new culture of like, and I mean obviously for years the right conservatives have always been the oppressive oppressive kind of like sense, but now you almost see this new culture among the left where, especially online and social media, there's almost this mob like mentality where if you step out of line, say the wrong thing, we're gonna shame you.
Yes.
And almost
in fact,
like
it might just be a hashtag about you.
Exactly. We're gonna ruin your life. We're gonna make you out to look like the biggest monster and evil thing that has ever existed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting because there's almost like a level of intolerance to that. That there's the script, and if you deviate from the script, you kind of like
shame
get punished.
On you. Why are
like,
you?
Like, how dare you even
we
think that?
We will expose you and destroy you. That's how they behave. It's so hectic. So the world, and I. That's how I. Sometimes I get to a point where I'm just like, well, let 1,000 schools of thought contend. Let, you know, 1,000 more flowers bloom. Because the also what makes us progress in society and move is that contradiction and where we complement and contradict each other with the different views, the different ideas, the different models. You actually see progress as opposed to where no one gives their view. You know, nothing moves. You know. Obviously, it just needs to be structured submission of views, where one listens to the other, like as opposed to where people just throw in ideas, you know, then that also becomes chaotic.
I guess that's the dream, I guess, that we're trying to realize in the end, is a real society where people can differ and still be constructive. But I always feel like in every sect, there's the people who almost like are willing to really believe that and do that. And then there's like the extremists who essentially at every opportunity will want to make the world in their image.
Yes, like, all right, and it's my way or no way. Like, at some point, you have to submit. You have to be like, I succumb. There has to be, so it's compromise at the center of it. Is that you sometimes have to then realize that you have to compromise your views to be able to progress. And that's what I think makes people move from one grouping to the other and from one sector to the other, where you reach a point where you cannot compromise. What becomes your non-negotiable state? Is your non-negotiable like, if they're saying by any means necessary, which means we can murder? Or is your non-negotiable by any means necessary, which means you can run around up until you stop at having to actually murder? So that's how I think society then begins to organize itself around what becomes a non-negotiable for them and what becomes. And fundamental to that is people's ideological views, people's religious views, people's ethical views about things. And that's how, like, people group themselves and move, you know? Yeah.
So we're in almost like in a ideological, like, warfare of some sort. But at the same time, there are some of us who are willing to make peace on certain levels of our differences with others. And then there are others who just don't, who are not willing to compromise. And they keep trying to rally the rest of us. Exactly. To join their holy war.
Exactly. You know, and that's what makes people far right, far left, extremists, conservatives, on that basis, depending on whether you're willing to, at which point do you want to compromise for the good of the collective, at which point do you not compromise, and so forth. It's like, I think, a question of your religion or your belief, a Satanist versus a Muslim versus a Buddha, a Buddhist versus a Christian, you know, and how they contending views, and to which point do they say, actually, let's all go drink together. And others would be like, I will not drink with these heathens, you know, like.
Yeah, I think what's also been interesting for me to see when I also had to look at myself is, for a long time, the world has been trying to push us to, you're either this like conservative guy who doesn't believe in abortion or homosexuality, and you know, you believe in, you were all these traditional, or you're this leftist guy who believes in like socialism and, and whatever. But what I found is that over time, there's almost like bits and pieces of both that you learn to carry. And I feel like as human beings, we have a little bit of these views that are like leftist and a little bit of these views that are righteous. And in today's world, you're almost forced to always have to choose. You're either completely subscribing to this specific narrative or the other one. But in reality, when you look deep, you realize that I might, you know, like some might believe that, okay, cool, I do love foreigners. Foreigners are great. But I also do believe that we need to control our borders, you know. And that doesn't necessarily make you like xenophobic, and it just makes you a person who has a specific stance in one aspect and another stance in another aspect.
True. And the debate, and it's an interesting topic you're raising, the debate on immigration. In fact, I think for me, the biggest question is, how do you have a discussion on immigration without becoming xenophobic? There are those who can genuinely have a discussion, and that's why I respected Malusi for so long, is because he could have the discussion on immigration and borders. In fact, he tightened the policy on immigration and borders, yet still embracing the fact that we live in a diverse world, and we live in a global world where it's okay for you to come in, but come in legally. You know, and be a productive person when you come in, and so forth, as you move around the world. Then there are those who are like, hey, and ngeke, close those borders, they must never come in. In fact, they are taking our space, they are taking our food, they are taking our... Those are the extremists that are problematic, because they then can't have a sober debate on immigration without being discriminatory. So the fundamental word being discriminatory. So anything, once you begin to have a discussion about a system, a plan, a model, once you're planning around it to become discriminatory in nature, then your plans must collapse, because it's not just. So once you begin, that's like what I'm doing, for example. Once I begin to isolate all the people that belong to the horrible boss and say, actually, I'm going to deal with these people last, becomes the system is then corrupted. So that for me is the thing, is that we've got to be able to have our, hold our different views, but our views must be for the for the sake of progress and not for the sake of discrimination. Once your views become for the sake of discrimination, that's why even the discussion of closing the borders is a in principle and in the fundamental belief is an incorrect discussion to have, because there are no borders. Borders are the ones that were created by colonialists, you know, that divided us as Africans. And therefore, once you begin to say close your borders, you are then becoming an African. So now another person may believe, I don't care, you know, and stuff. I don't care, want to know what the rest of the continent are. And the good thing is, I've realized, like, people's views change. They become nicer once they've traveled the continent. You know, their views completely change and they evolve as opposed, and they mature in their views, as opposed to those who I've seen who've actually never left the country. So they don't know that there's a whole world that exists outside of South Africa, and therefore they're not willing to know. It's just close that border so that you discriminate. You know, and that for me is where... So any system where it becomes oppressive, repressive, discriminatory is a system that is problematic. And that can be supported.
It's a good point, actually. I've also seen, even when it comes to like general kind of like discrimination, there's almost a relationship between how exposed you are to something, to things different to you, and your ability to almost be open-minded. So it's always these guys in the small little town where they don't interact with everybody else that are like so super, super extra on a certain like racial or whatever discriminative.
Take me, like. Me, like.